Welcome to the Talking Earth for mid-October, whenever you're listening to this. I'm Dan Raphael. We have three fine Portland poets reading here tonight, Sam Lohman, Andrea Hollander, and Jim Shugru. For the last 2 years, I've been doing one show every other month. With the recent death of Talking Earth co-founder Walt Curtis, I'll now be monthly, every third Monday, when we start. Last week's Talking Earth was a tribute to Walt, with some recordings of Walt's poems by Walt and others, and a few longtime friends of Walt talking about him. You really should listen to it if you haven't already. You can listen to it again. It's marvelous. KBOO.FM, go to programs, go to the Talking Earth, and you can find all of our shows. Might be where you found this one, and there's show's been going on a while. KBOO is in the middle of its fall Fresh Off the Vine fun drive. KBOO is non-commercial, 24/7 community radio, and gets most of its money it needs from members like you, like me. Since you're hearing me, you're a KBOO listener, and hopefully one of the 10% of KBOO listeners who contribute to the station. If not, no time like now to help keep KBOO going into its 56th year and beyond. So we'll enough of commercials for non-commercial radio. That's a commercial for us, so I think that's different. But let's start off with Sam Lohman. Sam is a poet and librarian living in Vancouver, Washington. He's the author of several books and pamphlets, including Stand on This Picnic Bench and Look North from Publication Studio, and Unless As Stone Is from Eth Press. He's a co-organizer of Portland's long-running Spare Room Reading Series. Recent poems of Sam's have appeared or are about to appear in the magazines Luigi Ten Co. and Hot Pink. So, enough of me. Here's Sam.
I brought mostly some new stuff, but I wanted to start with an old one that I feel like is interesting to read on the radio, or I wanted it to be on the radio. And the title of it is The Invention of Solidarity. It is from a manuscript that I was writing when my kid was a baby and a toddler. And this one is from 2016, kind of like right after the Trump election. And it's got, I think it's got that vibe. Whatever that is. As if I had a right to color things in. As if I had a right to say, you. You have gone out to join things. You have gone to be with the dead, sharing a banana, sharing a sheet. The fantasy of sharing a skin puts us to sleep or jerks us awake. The fantasy of reading bodies forestalls the adventure story I wanted. As if there were a right, as if there were means to color and feel. The invention of photography was the invention of solidarity. That's one theory. You have gone out to become a photograph. You've gone out in your worn velour and graphic sense and rubbing at the impropriety. With one look, you've tied me in an imaginary communism, like scarves, sashes, rigging. Start with how we'll never share soup or even light. Start with who you're willing to hide in your bedroom and who I pretend to be on the street. Say the discovery of difficulties at your kitchen table was the invention of solidarity in the street. It's empty bed theories and blues. When crossing a tangle, you get susceptible trying to read the intersections. This invention can't wait until spring. Last night, 23 degrees in North Dakota, they turned on the water cannons. This morning, I went to work and couldn't work. The juxtaposition proves nothing. Who is speaking proves nothing, or your body was shown to prove nothing by the National Guard. So how am I still writing this to my grandmother? How does a neighborhood samba or a nation come unguarded? Not that I claim a nation or neighborhood. I'm not even a placeholder. Only say I vibrate. Only say I'm blank registry. I'm wearing my sedentary mentalism pin. I'm only you because your little pig knows it. I won't say violence is the invention of solidarity. I will say I'm learning to step aside. I don't have any bruises to show, and what's a step in hell? It's a theory like arranging to be beside yourself and other political economies. Like you could come to the "I guess I'm saying" part and just keep walking. You never meet parallel people. You can have that axiom. Or, sentimentally, hell is parallel people. Let cross purposes be our wishes. Let our wishes be incommensurable. C wants to become a spoon feeder. M speeds to destabilize the stable. Thrills keep seeking pilgrims. Pilgrimage is losing. Losing is journalism. The better part of losing is the habit of holding on. Clearly, there could never be a habit of solidarity, but the mudflat keeps instructing the river otters on how to hold hands with bank tellers and robbers. See, the oats are asleep in the horses' mouths. The hands are asleep in the paws. The stoker is cradling the soggy engineer. Peace to your theories. Peace to your fucked up centuries. Peace to your ancient predicaments. Peace to your moss and its tree frog. Peace to your pulleys and guy wire. May hideous hindsight guide us through. So that's that one. And then I brought some newer poems from a new manuscript that I just kind of arbitrarily picked ones that are coming out in journals or have recently come out. So I have a couple that are coming out in this nice online journal called Hot Pink, or Hot, maybe it's Hot Pink Magazine. This one is Against the Moment. A parallel feeling? Doesn't sound so terrible, but then some of us know how to modulate the chest cavity. Pops in and out of alignment with earth and trees. Not my fault we live in a country where touches don't meet and have no need for traffic circles on our way from crystal into conifer. So when we make paths, they double up like tiny pine needle refrains, choruses of bobby pins. You have my permission to splash your face and forget them. Not that you'd ever need it. It's gratuitous. Hats off, little fingers up in the air. An ever more unlandable plane booming out its shyness, as am I, apparently. Ugh. The rest is history, the lickable kind. Look for me there, resisting the national pastime, passing out under the eglantine. Some other time we'd touch and go and hardly recognizable, though truth be told, your expression hasn't changed. If you felt like tickling the void, though, well, we could start anywhere. How soon? This is called On Social Mirages. In winter sun, the car's shadows jump alongside and veer up into your lane, but let's not trace the whole freeway. After the rise of the overpass, mirages that persist get pretty boring to explain or practice. How, in the act of using it up, can you ask if it's any use anymore? When Collage I is talking again, who does the walking? Montage guy. Putting in a word, like calling it a utility bike, as a way of sneering at the desire to ever get anywhere. Veering into your crowd of recognizables, what you'd call your lane, lit by winter sun at angles, fast. This one's not going to be in that journal, but I wanted to slide it in as an intro to the next poem. This one's called The Will to Live in a Country Song. I'm a formalist of oil and water and G.I. Joe parts. Green and beige and unearthly lavender, more fragile than dry pine twigs. There's a butchered metaphor you can holler when you just want to say hi. It knocks your face off like a snake says howdy. When you just want the swivel to live as the bed of. You want it to be hooked up like an effective truck, where attention to cleats forwards the unthought connection, clean as a snake's belly. Clean as a cowboy dressed for revenge. Victim to serious swagger, part dinosaur, part mockingbird. Entirely formal in lavender when walking after midnight. Don't drown in the sheep dip. Dress in the denim ocean again. Step in the swill to live. This one's called Her Song. Missing a city for her sins, Venus of the cowboy songs reads about the lost cities. How are they lost? In wheels and wheels? And what comes after cowboy songs? No development. Quiet quitting. Try not to give a rat's ass out in the August white basalt and oat straw west. This passing gesture city, pink, deciduous, rambling where you hear her sing. All the while been a patient of signals. All the while been a prisoner of emeralds. It's how I arrived at the gulches of roses. It's how I perished the thought. All the while and shake the vine. Bake the cabbage I wanted you to know me by for all this while. It's how I leave a trail of perfect emeralds. No, I didn't. I can't decide about thought and health. I'd rather be burlesque, spiral into friskiness, and what comes after cowboy songs. Me, Venus of the cowboy songs, taking a free ride here on the world's only naturally occurring railroad. Like a young skunk in an old tire, effective Venus of the skunk, affected lady of sufficient cause, rose matter, attar, and planned skin glow. Somebody open a window. For all of life, preparing a sniff. Been ready to climb out all this while. Lists of flowers, don't mind me. It's how I prepare a dehydrated grove. Before and in advance of fire. How much they mind me standing around. It's how I chop the day up. Not a comment on how we hold ourselves out. Isn't this a neat wreck anymore? It's carefree when the windows meet the water in the headlights in my song. I'll do a couple from this really lovely journal called Luigi Tenco, which I guess is named after not Luigi from Mario, but a famous Italian singer named Luigi Tenco. I'm very happy to have some poems in here. It's published in Colorado. Here's one entitled, A Flat Father. A father at the beach lectures on line of sight and thinks the kids are in... Excuse me, I'll start that one again. A flat father. A father at the beach lectures on line of sight and thinks that trees are in the way. His kid only loves bees and isn't listening. The grass rises up before them. The father is instantly flattened, invested in tapestry. Eyes eating through forever from under the tableau find clover-thickened dirt picture, swarming the colors drink up bees quicker than eyes, rooted in place, regain the third dimension. So a dirt picture is a death mask, limed into place in the clefts. You can rattle your chains, you can jog the frame, but there you are, verdigris character witness to chrysoprase. Bouncing in place, and wild green celery raving parked in the feral velvet car at a local precipice, while in the story The Dead Season by Bruno Schultz, a flat father is stopped in the sunlight, but then by an act of will detaches himself and unchains the doors. As in the other stories, he keeps dying and going on, diminished, escapes at last as a boiled gelatin, rotted, reconstitute arthropod, some kind of scorpion trilobite crab, which just goes to show you, the backside of the tapestry, no good to call it the negative of anything. Better call a friend. Call up a spiritual thread picture. Not that I insist on a certain meadowness when the lawn is late September straw waiting to drink. Later, blue windshield wiper fluid leaked everywhere in the dirt picture. Later, the cat sat, waiting under the car for me, odalisking, like an orange asshole sphinx, looking at me like that, and I did too. Our hearts were sizzling like a cobbler, with red dye in a patient street, waiting to drink up the earth like a theory of happiness drawn by eye, tangled but moving, moving on actual legs, dirt trees, dirt clouds. This one is called Fine Shreddingness. He was keeping his glue pot boiling as a saint of Hanover, no facts on offer, held in a circle of rudimentary wicker, made to express disgust. Trace the evasion around the emotion, at an odd time so it won't elapse. It's a real sky, but I don't believe it. There goes Moses in his 10-cent envelope canoe, ever shredding. I'll steal what scratching I can while he gets the spiritual transitions in order, tending to the baby and the guinea pig, finding odd seconds to piece torn scraps together. For the first time, the latest psychosomatic submission. Spell it F-I-N-E-N-E-S-S-E, if you think of it, as shredding, what skaters and bureaucrats do daily, perpetual but constantly interrupted, trace of feeling around the escape, because I can't always feel it. I keep doing it to see what happens. Last one, this one is called Wind Section. Ultimate board-faded monologue droning in our noses feels like breathing through a straw time of life, of lost time spent looking through crystals, as if to make something that already happened happen.
Thanks, Sam. And now I'm going to read you a couple poems from Mary Bernard, literary treasure with strong Portland connections. If you're not familiar with her work, you should be. Well, you'd be better off if you were. She's also well known for her translations of Sappho and, well, lots about her. But here's just a couple things by her from her collected poems. Find my mark here. The Rapids. No country is so gracious to us as that which kept its contours while we forgot them, and whose valleys, closed under receding hills, opened to our return. The water we saw broken upon the rapids has dragged silt through marshland and mingled with the embittered streams of the sea. One might have kept sweet pulsiful and kept nothing. But the ungatherable blossoms floating by the same rock, the chisel marks on the surface in full flight, have flung light in my face, have made promises in ceasing, unceasing undertone. The River Under Different Lights, which is in three parts. One, the gorge. Light has the dull luster of pewter, and the clouds move sidewise, clawing the tops of the crags, resting their soft gray bellies briefly in high valleys. Foam, plowing against the rapids, gathers all brightness. Two, the ship. A ship that passes inland between mountains moves as though resting from the sea's labor. Riders in the fogging buses peer at snatches of river between Madrona and Fur, at the prow of a white vessel dividing reflected forests, a gesture compact with stillness. Three, the estuary. Where fresh water meets salt, a simple wave shears the fog with a slow edge, lifted by tide or current or hull's pressure. Nothing is sure. Neither tide, season, nor hour, in this flux of stream and ocean, daylight and fog, where only the fish, a secret presence, moves surely on spring's errand. And close with this one from Mary Bernard, collected poems. Height is the distance down. What's geography? What's difference what mountain it is? In the intimacy of this altitude, its discolored snowfields overhang half the world. On a knife rim, edge up into whirlpools of sky, feet are no anchor. Gravity sucks at the mind, spinning the blood-weighted body head downward. The mountain that had become a known profile on the day's horizon is a gesture of earth swinging us above falling spaces, above a map of the world. Disturber of the unseen, provoker of the gusts in which we bend, struggling against destruction, gaping eastward. The wind fails, the breath held, the illusion of death. The resting shoulder, unopposed, lurches west in innocent still air, as steep as deep. Mary Barnard. And yes, Kebu is in its fall fresh off the vine fun drive. We are commercial free, community sponsored, and you are the community. Check out kebu.fm for how you can help Kebu going into its 56th year. And now another fine local poet, Andrea Hollander. Andrea is the author of 6 full-length collections, including the just-released and now Nowhere But Here from Terrapin Books, Blue Mistaken for Sky, which was a finalist for the Best Book Award in Poetry from the American Book Fest, and Landscape with Female Figure, a finalist for the Oregon Book Award. Her poems appear widely, including a feature in the New York Times Magazine. With over 30 years of teaching experience, she currently conducts the Ambassador Writer Seminar via Zoom. Her website is AndreaHollander.net or www.AndreaHollander.net. And here she is.
The first few poems I'm going to share are from my new book, and now Nowhere But Here from Terrapin Books. And although the material in the book is autobiographical, and some of it comes from my childhood and the years since, I moved to Portland in 2011 from the Ozarks of Arkansas, where I lived for 35 years. I'm going to share today only Portland poems. The first one is called Last Day in the Short-Term Apartment. Snow coming down hard, the movers having taken all my furniture and boxes to my new place, I stand at the window that faces the parking lot, snow so fierce I can't see anything but the slanting white lines it makes through the air as if trying to get somewhere more important. I turn away and survey the vacant room, its built-in bookcase empty now except for a greeting card that lies on its side, the nail holes I need to fill in the wall, deep depressions in the carpeting left from everything that made this more than a mere room. How to say goodbye to such a place, a refuge. I moved in after a trauma forced me out of the life I thought was mine. And this apartment, why not say it, saved me. Before I hung paintings by my grown son, he took me to IKEA and spent every day for the next 2 weeks assembling my new dining table and chairs, bed frame. Dressers, desk, the convertible sofa he sometimes slept on. I turn again toward the window. The snow slow now, the sky's blue begins to peek through. I will miss this view, I hear myself say aloud, startled by the sudden sound of my own voice. In the distance, I make out the flattened Mount St. Helens. Like me, she stayed poised and silent a long time before letting herself go. After I left the apartment that is featured in that poem, I moved to Southwest 6th Avenue, which is one of the transit mall streets, one lane for the MAX train, one lane for buses, one lane for the rest of us, and one lane for parking. This poem comes from the experience of living in this new, to me, apartment. Muse. Some mornings, my muse comes in the form of the man who rolls the garbage bins up the alley to the street, and I understand it's the rhythm of his clatter and to imitate in my lines. Other mornings, my muse arrives disguised as the recorded voice monotoning warnings from the light rail train that stops in front of my building every 15 minutes, that voice uttering the same two sentences over and over, no matter which train or what time of day or night. The doors are closing, train departing, please hold on. This morning, more and more flakes of cold that an hour ago gentled my view of the valley have hardened. The alley now whiter than the empty page in my notebook, and still my muse has not come. Even so, I sit at my persistent table, the window beside me blurring with condensation, a sudden gust of wind muting the trains. If my muse shows up, I might stop thinking, at least for the length of a poem, about my brother dying of cancer on the other side of the country. The wind stops, and I hear that voice I know so well. The doors are closing, it says. Please hold on. Not every poem in the book is depressing, as this next poem will prove. Before COVID, I was exclusively on public transportation. After COVID, I had to take a break from public transportation because I was on immune-suppressing medication, and we hadn't even been told how to protect ourselves. But before that, I started a series of poems in which I named the bus that I'm taking, the place I'm coming from, and the destination. This is one of those poems. Bus 14, downtown to Southeast 34th and Hawthorne. The sun hot on my shoulders, the bus stop crowded, the bus, full when it reaches us and now fuller, pulls east toward the Hawthorne Bridge and more east across the hectic street where more and more cars slow the traffic. And I try not to sway as I stand in the aisle, one arm up to grasp the grab bar, the other around the bouquet from Giffords I hover over like the mother of a newborn. At each stop, the aisle growing calmer, emptier, and most of us relieved enough at our departure to shout thanks to the driver whose face I forget altogether as the sun glints off the Baghdad Theater, and I step off the bus and leave the sound of all that traffic behind and turn down this residential street that grows quieter and a little bit cooler while I move beneath tulip trees no longer in bloom, although snapdragons and hollyhocks rise like an entourage on either side of the sidewalk, the closer I get to the dinner Suzanne has been making all day in her kitchen, the bouquet I carry quite unharmed, the freesias I wanted so out of season, the clerk pulled three blue hydrangeas from a pail, then from a glass door cooler, four yellow roses, and wrapped them together in a funnel of plain tan paper, the scent of the roses just as I reach Suzanne and Robert's house, overtaken by the odor of simmering curry that strays through the screen door and out onto the porch to greet me. Some of you might know Suzanne Sigafoos, who's also a poet, and that's whose house I was going to, and her husband is Robert Peterson. Many of you know the unique bookstore Mother Foucault's, and this next poem takes place there. The painting at Mother Foucault's bookshop. I'm more taken by this large oil of the bookshop than by the real thing. On canvas, the wall-length spread of used books, dozens more stacked on tables, a pale pink overstuffed chair. In the lower right corner, I recognize the shadow of the bookshop's owner, shoulders slumped, head turned away. And at the painting's center, the almost floor-to-ceiling storefront window, sunlight striking the facades of the shops across the street, just as they look right now. I must be standing in the spot where the local artist stood at his easel. I should be scanning shelves and tables for the book I came to buy, or asking the clerk, a young man with a tattooed arrow on his cheek, whom the artist didn't include. But I can't stop long enough to stop comparing details of the painting with what's actual. All this time, a short, balding man in a green t-shirt has been pacing the sidewalk out front, back and forth nonstop in the summer glare. I have days like his, unmoored, no matter where I truly am. Much more often, I'm like the painted version of the bookshop's owner in someone else's vision of me, an immovable shadow, my back turned against all possible intrusions, a lone figure wondering why light, real light, shines everywhere else. The next poem, it takes place here in Portland, but as you'll see, it travels elsewhere. Not much snow last night, but enough to powder the sidewalk at midnight when I last looked down from my fourth floor apartment. This morning, the scraping sound of a shovel made me think of my father back in New Jersey, in that life that lives only when I remember it. Dad in his gray wool coat and woolen fedora, with its tiny yellow feathers sewn into the band. Outdoors before anyone else in the house is up. The snow only an inch thick at most. Our flagstone walkway cleared. And Dad now on the sidewalk nearly to the corner, his scraping faint but persistent enough to wake my mother, soon in her white chenille bathrobe, those same backless slippers, standing at the picture window in the living room of that house, my younger brother still asleep upstairs, Mom about to yell up to him to get dressed and go out to help. I was not there, but I lived in that house till I left for college, and I know what I know. Today's light snow, followed by the sound of shoveling on a street in Portland, Oregon, will bring me my father in winter, years before the Alzheimer's takes hold, determined as always to do everything himself. And months before she finds the lump, my mother trying to make him stop. My brother, decades before his own diagnosis, oblivious that anything worse will ever disturb him more than our mother's voice calling him from his safe, warm bed. I think I will close with two poems, one from each of my last two books. First, the previous book, which was my fifth, Blue Mistaken for Sky, from Autumn House Press, that was published in 2018. It's also a Portland poem, of course, because I promised myself and I promised you that I would read only Portland poems. Blossom. That's blossom, blossom. I was not alone one bitter winter night, waiting for the bus back to the city from the outskirts. A tall, middle-aged man with a straggly beard uncombed hair and stained trousers with frayed cuffs, pace the empty street in front of me, smoking. I doubt he gave me a single thought. Solitary older woman in a woolen hat and long black winter coat and scarf. The wind wheezed, and I wound the scarf tighter around my neck. The man kept pacing, smoking, his ungloved hands red and chapped. When the bus finally came, he didn't toss his cigarette into the street, nor crush it on the sidewalk, but instead tapped it against the glass wall of the kiosk gently until it was out. Then, with the kind of care I once gave the delicate blossom of a trillium for which I scouted the forest for hours, he tucked the small stub into a pocket of his denim jacket and stepped up into the bus before me. And finally, from my previous my previous book to that one, Landscape with Female Figure, which was a finalist for the Oregon Book Awards. It's a new and selected, and it was published in 2013, also by Autumn House Press. And it takes place in 2011, the same month I first moved to Portland. Overture, Portland, Oregon, April 2011. So I stepped off the streetcar and walked to the bus stop, marveling at the city around me and at the young woman I could never be, standing as if beautiful with her tattooed neck and metal studs through her nose and ears. And actually, she was beautiful, singing a familiar tune, its notes of grace filling the space between the two of us. And suddenly, too, a limping man with his cardboard "will work for food" sign, like the title of a poem and not his life. But who was he then? Because he began to hum, and the woman, teeth not yellow like his, smiling at him, reached into the breast jacket of her denim jacket while she sang and fluttered a $5 bill toward him like some butterfly, which reminded me of my mother who sang on the bed of her death as if song could keep her alive. Or maybe it was I who imagined this, a prayer not for the dead but from the dying. My mother in her purple gown, singing as if death were not the name of anything, but part of an overture, her brown eyes earnest like those of the woman at the bus stop in my new city where I did not know yet who I would become. But now it seemed I was at least a singer at a bus stop, for my own voice joined in without my permission, and the three of us hovered in the mellifluous air on the darkening sidewalk as the bus came to us and lifted us together. And thank you. And thank you, Dan Raphael.
Thanks, Andrea. And hey, one advantage of doing a show like this is you can present some of your own work. Here's a recent poem of mine. I'm always mystified by them. Not always, usually. What will we eat when we get there? When we saw from the ground, not the air. When you could only use the openings the body came with. Buildings no taller than the straightest trees. Everything else we could patch in peace. Rolling instead of folding. Circular cloaks, dervish skirts. From how fast is memory? a past face in a new place, the city pigtails from some center uncertain, cause the pig is still walking, lost in truffle dreams. Restaurants below dirigibles confuse the hunting dog when the only fox served is foe. The young beauties whose only solid meal is lunch, like we're back in dormitories flashing our food cards, racing to be the last one in. The harder it rains, the emptier the fridge, the more widespread our hungers. Dream food steams thickly in our hands like a sauna powered by cauldrons of corned beef and cabbage. I wake to my lover licking that flavor from my back, dreaming of summer and the ginger lemonade lake, of that secret camping space in the garlic tomato forest. Here where the street used to end, when we had several paths over the hill, like folding the map of the world into an umbrella. How many countries can I remove and stay dry? If all the continents were once huddled together, what was on the other side and where did it go? Like a lake where downtown used to be, cause the oceans rose a foot, maintaining the highways so the stubborn can drown, learning to taste bad cause there's too many mosquitoes to kill. Why make your own blood when the synthetic is much more efficient and adds a compulsive glow? Bloodshot, blood sausage, bloodhound. Drain the kill but save the pudding. By eating the liver, we eat the creature's past, all that went through it. Drinking from kidneys, lungs could be a bagpipe or a bong. Before the stomach's full, it started making room for more. And now, that was me. Jan Raphael, and now our third featured reader, longtime now retired bookseller Jim Shagru. Jim has published three chapbooks, Floating Verses, Small Things Screaming, which was a finalist for the Oregon Book Award, and Ice Water, as well as Cards and Letters, a book of poetry and images in collaboration with artist Paul Schopp. Jim's received an Open Voice Award from the West Side Y in New York and a fellowship from the Oregon Arts Commission. So here is Jim.
Thanks, Dan, for inviting me to read, and thanks to Kebu for helping to keep poetry alive here in Poetland. I'd like to read a few more or less new poems during the lockdown period. It's always hard to know what anything sounds like when you're only reading it to yourself. Now, I know I live with another poet, and she's always a helpful and receptive audience, but then she listens with the ears of love, so I can't really trust her judgment entirely of what I write. This first poem is called Tourist Season. The angry locals drive too fast. Those of us who come to gawk get in the way of their abrupt desires. They know the roads, and knowledge lets them pay attention only to the time it takes to get from one end to the other. What has happened here, what happens still, with every season's shifting constancy, what we call history, geology, is just to them a stretch of road to get through to get home, or to some job, or party, or some love, perhaps illicit. Hidden in towns, the time has worn down to nothing more than a name, a tavern, a convenience store with one gas pump between which accidents occur. This one is called At a Loss for Words. I admire the thin poems some people write, fit to enter and exit through keyholes, to slide under doors like love letters or apologies, blades of language sharpened to an almost non-existent edge, slicing speech into fine translucent syllables through which we feel the breath of every breathing thing, the trickle of time's blood. This is a poem. And back to Chicago, to the lagoons in Lincoln Park that used to freeze over in the wintertime and provide us with a place to ice skate. This one is called Ice Skating on the Lagoon. Beneath a few inches of crust, the fish swim with their fishy frowns. impatient for spring, when we'll stop dancing like new immigrants day after day on their ceiling in our clumsy iron shoes. In the temporary shack by the glowing wood stove, we cry over frozen feet, hands hot on paper cups of chocolate. Outside, a man who drives a bread truck every day from corner store to corner store, speed skates, one hand behind his back, holding his leather blade guards, the other rising high above him, then plunging gracefully back, in rhythm with crouched legs, in steady motion, making long circles around the edges of the stumbling young. Fast and accurate, and more than we imagined any mere adult could be. This one is called Vacations. That's sort of self-explanatory. It's been around a little while longer than some of these, because I keep trying to write a vacation poem, and it turns out being the same one. So this one is called Vacations. Vacations are small exiles we impose on ourselves, getting used to being lost among the things we've come to see. By the time we know our way around the ancient city, the seaside resort, we've grown tired of strangeness and are ready for our lives again. The view from the cabin window, the cafe terrace of the old hotel, pose for postcards of themselves. Impatient with sublimity, we walk the beach and gather pebbles to bring home to spread under the backyard picnic table, tokens of difference to keep familiarity confused. This one is a new poem. I'm calling it Quilting. When my mother's father died, my grandmother made a quilt of all his ties. A traveling salesman, he had a lot of ties, and ties were wide those days, and often silk. Some thought it morbid, others just economical. Recycling wasn't a concept yet. People just used things rather than let them go to waste. Neither had Freud much currency in Iowa back then. But when you think of it, it's hard to imagine sleeping under those displays of masculine vanity, those bits of brightness in dull suits that said, "I'm not entirely tame." Gaudy fabrications in a culture of stale jokes, a salesman's comic threat, which makes a wife's incorporation of them into her home economy betray a firmer and sharper stitch. I do most of the cooking around our house, in part because I have weird allergies and I don't wish to make anyone else have to pay attention to such things. But this one's called Winter Soups. All the dark, wet months, I make a large pot of soup each Sunday, enough to last, with additions, through the week. Chicken, beans, old recipes varied with improvisation. Peppers, garlic, onions, the constant start that fills the house with warmth. Smells good, you say, drawn by it into the kitchen, sipping the broth from the shallow ladle, taking comfort in the steam. The squash or meat or vegetables, fish and potatoes, yams and leeks, simmer for hours until the taste infuses everything, and we dish out full bowls and serve with crusty bread, cheap travel, to whatever country's spice we borrow gratefully. This soup that feeds us and whoever wanders in is a gift from so many hungry generations. What can we do but eat? This is another one. I haven't got a title for this one. I have a trouble with titles. I have to do a poem about how hard it is to write, to come up with titles for poems, but I don't have that one with me. And that doesn't have a title either, as far as I remember. This one, provisionally, we'll call first line title or something like that. A woman stands on a stage is the first line. A woman stands on a stage and sings an old song anew. Another night in a city where all the songs, however innocent, contain the treason of remembering. The band consists of refugees from everywhere, brought here by forgery and luck. Each keeps a suitcase packed, a passport in an inner pocket, is one sleep away from yet another flight. The lyrics speak of times before and times to be, but the way she sings them makes them say that now is all the time there is or ever was, and all the sadness in the world is here and now, and we've survived it just again. This is one, I guess this is a common malapropism. I wasn't aware of it. My mother was a mistress of malapropisms. She used to say stupot when she meant stupid. When she was calling me stupid, she'd be standing there calling me stupot, and I'd have to try to correct her. But I'd have the urge to try to correct her, but was unwilling or unwise enough not to do so, because that would make me even more stupot. This one is called You Take Me for Granite. You take me for granite, my mother used to say. What did she know of grants or granting? Though she understood hard stone and what it meant to be mistaken for it, to be and be assumed to be deflecting, impermeable, an unresponding thing that to be up against was more than any soft permission gave. She knew she was not what we took her for, and knew we took and took, expecting always the surface to return our scrapes and bounces. All we gave to the unfeeling that she felt we were, the accusation of existence. The only common ground we had was all she thought we knew, and was all we thought we knew, and all she let us know we didn't. We live uphill from the Brooklyn rail yards, and I guess because it's uphill, we get to hear the shunting engines, or the engines being shunted all night long. And I kind of like it. It's kind of a Hank Williams vibe, but this one I call Landscape. The rail yards sing all night, keeping us awake, or else we sleep and dream of freight shunted from one siding to another, of riders so thin they hide behind the glint of moonlight reflected on the letters of their names spray-painted on the walls of what our hunger tells us to forget in the restless fiction of our real estate. The night is going somewhere we will never be. These noises in the dark are all that's left us of our wanderlust. We're at a loss for lostness, gone to ground. This one is called In the Painting of the Heretic's Martyrdom. In the painting of the heretic's martyrdom, what we see is only what the painter happened to include, the details and distractions of the crowd, beyond which the rest of the city continues. If you walk past the edges of the frame, you can pass through 100 other heresies, millions of indifferent observers, bonfires in each square, each waiting to embrace its tender miscreant. And if you walk past the edges of that frame, the world continues on in time and place until it reaches this here, this now, this you, and everything at stake. Two more. Three more. This one is called Art History. I've been 86 from the museum. They caught me kissing the Etruscans. The ancient world is too much with me. I can't resist the mutilation time whispers through its stones, or telling my life story to the blank exclusion of their eyes. They've been unloved so long, I know. I know the feeling, and they belong here even less than I. Time and distance and the interpretations of the field of the tour guides get us equally wrong. We know each other better than they think. How can we abide our difference? How dare we touch upon the varied ways we took to end up lost here in each other? How will we find us home? This is a slightly older poem, but I keep reading it. I kind of like it. It was written at a time when I was expecting to go in for some surgery, and I was kind of uncertain as to what the future was going to be. So this one is called That Said. An old couple crossing a busy street reach instinctively to hold each other's hands, a small quotation from a lifetime of embraces. What is love? A question asked, expecting no answer. A question you know better than to ask, but ask again and again, each time phrasing it a little differently, expecting always the same absence of answer, always phrased also a little differently. The city is full of doors that open into hallways, full of other doors behind which there are rooms, and in those rooms, tables and chairs, and yes, too, beds and bodies moving through the dance of life and death, and they are more than you will ever know, and you want them more than you can say. Tell that to anyone who'll listen. Or else, the beauty of a dream from which you wake, afraid of who you are after so much bliss, suitcases on the top shelves of closets full of clothes gone out of fashion, worn by ghosts of worry, hope, despair, I don't know, do you? We reach instinctively to take each other's hand amidst the traffic, which is the world, and we are in and of the world, and it is dangerous, and that is what we know of love. One more short poem. This one, I guess, trying to comfort myself about what it is I'm on about with this poetry stuff. There are worse things than growing old in poetry. You've always got someone to talk to, though most of them are dead, which is not that different from the rest of the lonely old, except you're dead, return the compliment and answer back. What they whisper to you late at night is that failure and success are empty words, that the true grasp of anything amount to a mouth full of air, and the only comfort in it is to let it out and call that exhalation song.
Thanks, Jim. One last reminder, not to be pestiferous, but that's what we're supposed to do. I mean, we only do this twice a year now, so, you know, I mean, you can send us money anytime. That's fine, but just a reminder now that this is KBOO's Fresh Off the Vine Fall Drive. KBOO is volunteer-powered, but we still have to pay for electricity and all that. Just not enough hamsters and wheels to keep our signal going 24/7 with a fresh variety of music and words that you know, hard to find anywhere else. So, you know, please contribute to KBOO.FM. I'll appreciate it. And hey, if you got time to come and volunteer, you can learn to radio. You can help us in the office. Help us raise money and, you know, bother people the next time. But KBOO.FM has lots of information for you. But then my thanks to KBOO and all its contributors, money and time-wise. Thanks to Talking Earth founders Walt Curtis and Barbara Lamorticella. Thanks to Talking Earth's Heart Glue host and engineer Patrick Bocard. That's every show. For this particular show, I want to thank my three featured readers, Sam Lohman, Andrea Hollander, and Jim Shigrua. I'm Dan Raphael, and here's just something that happened to me recently. About a dozen crows sitting in the top of a tall tree, another 12 to 15 flying around, mostly near the street. Then from the east, 25 to 30 crows come flying through, and the other two clusters join them, going where? Others joining them as they went? This is the Talking Earth. I'm Dan Raphael here at KBOO.FM 90.7 in Portland.